Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started this afternoon. We have a lot of material to cover, so I wanted to make sure we started as early as possible. I appreciate everyone's attendance, and I hope that you get a lot out of this. And really, the reason I'm excited about this series is that I hope that you can gain a lot of information that you can take out and join the fight of truth for the cause of Jesus Christ. So, based on a couple of comments from people, let's back up and do a little reflection on why we're doing this study. What is the purpose of this study? Well, since 1859, when Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species, the scientific community has taught the hypothesis that we all evolved from basically slime mold, microbe to man. This doctrine was purposely designed, which is historically documented, as an alternative to faith in God. That was the purpose of teaching evolutionary hypothesis, which is really not, actually is not even a scientific theory. And for the past 200 years, the biggest problem is that the church-going public have bought into this idea, so much so that denominations have even accepted the idea. And so there's really a two-pronged thrust of the humanists. The first prong was liberal theology that came from Western Europe to undermine the credibility of the Bible. The second prong of the thrust was evolution, to do away with the idea that we came from a divine source. In other words, to have a naturalistic means of explaining the world around us. Therefore, denominations such as the Anglican Church, Episcopal, Presbyterian, Methodist, United Church of Christ, Lutheran Church, I'm not saying this to slander anyone, but just stating the simple facts that can be documented by simply looking on the internet, these groups who have embraced liberal theology and accepted the theory of evolution, quote unquote, have seen their numbers plummet. And we've seen people lose their faith amongst these parishioners and denominations. It's clearly seen starting in Western Europe, going to England, going to America. Back in 1800, before Charles Darwin was born, when all of this started culminating, back when it was basically quote-unquote Christendom, people believed in the Bible and believed in Jesus Christ despite their denominational error. However, after liberal theology and the teaching of Darwinian evolution, people began to lose their faith, so much so that although in early 1800, almost all people in England, majority, 90%, went to church, by 1941 or 38, at the beginning of World War II, only 45% of people in England went to church. Today, that number is down to 7% of people in England go to church. And what we see is everything that happens in Western Europe is transferred to England, and we see the exact same thing happening today in America. And I think it's based on this two-pronged thrust of humanists, which is evolution and liberal theology. And so some people say, well, why is this teaching important? It's important for this reason. There are members of the church who are losing their faith. When I was in Texas last year, there was an elder teaching a class on evolution. He made some excellent points. And during the class, an older man in the back raised his hand and said, I don't know why we have to study all this. The Bible says the fool has said in his heart there is no God, and that's good enough for me. And you know, that is a good point. That was good enough for him. A deacon raised his hand in the back and very calmly and carefully made a very good observation. He said, it is true, most of us who are older are not going to be affected by this doctrine. And this was a very large church in Texas. But he said, our children are going off to the public institutions and they're losing their faith right and left. We see that all over the place. I had, two were friends and one was just an individual that I knew I'd met before. Three young men that all lost their faith, accepted evolution. All three of them preached. One was a full-time preacher. And now they've turned to agnosticism, atheism, and believe in evolution. Recently, I was lecturing in a place, and some individuals drove some distance to bring their 19-year-old son to talk to me. And they wanted me to help straighten him out on evolution. So he was a homeschooled student that had been reading on the internet and lost his faith in the Bible because of evolution. Just recently, last month, I was lecturing in the South, and a man came up to me after the lecture, and he said, I lost all three of my children to this teaching. And they lost their faith because of evolution. Also, very famous people, Richard Dawkins, the most outspoken atheist in the world. He used to be a Bible believer. He believed the Bible was literally inspired until he was converted to evolutionary thought. E.O. Wilson from Harvard University, Andrew Carnegie, all of these men lost their faith in God and became atheists because of Darwinian evolution. Therefore, we get to a quote such as you see here that we showed you a few weeks ago. How can you honestly deny science? And for those of you that don't know what's going on, this is what we're hearing today. In the public universities, and I went to a public state university that would be considered one of the most conservative in the country, and yet we heard this pounded into our heads, as well as in high school. In West Virginia, a rather rural conservative location, we heard these things, and I knew if I was hearing these things in conservative locales, people in more liberal locations are certainly hearing them. How can you honestly deny science, they say, and be so ignorant to the obvious truth about our beginnings? Stop leading people in nonsense and lies. If anyone has half a brain, they're going to listen to science for truth, and not 4,000-year-old stories written by goat herders. You know the problem there? This person has transferred his faith to science. He has more faith in science than God's Word, and I would wager to guess that if you went back in this young man's background, the person that wrote this, he would have had quote-unquote Christian or Bible-believing families. But the problem is we've placed science above the Bible. Okay, denominations have done that for years. And even in the church sometimes you hear that. Well, yeah, we understand this passage, but we have to interpret it based on science. Says who? When did science become the 67th book of the Bible? I don't think we see that in Scripture. I want to show you another quote. There's a man up in Canada named Steve Rudd. He has a website, Bible.ca, that has some very good material. On this website, he has some material, Evolution versus Creation, by Don Patton. I want you to look how one 15-year-old responds to this creation material. The 15-year-old young man says, "You take the Bible's Genesis stories word for word. How do you explain the fact that complex proteins are formed in a broth solution in a period of a few weeks? Can you explain the mutation of microbes when they become resistant to types of treatment? How do you explain the leading psychoanalysts are finding that homosexuality is a natural mind state, not a choice on the part of a person? Why would God hate this if He made people this way? This is just stupid. By the way, I am 15 years old. You have no control over my generation. Your efforts are pointless. Science is what is true. A theory that explains is better than a belief." This is not only what we're hearing in the public school system, this is what I'm hearing in my job in the federal government regarding diversity, regarding the fact that the old archaic system has to be done away with. So what are we trying to do? My purpose, and then we'll move on, is twofold. Number one, to make you understand that scientism is not a valid explanation for our origins. What is scientism? The belief that all things can be understood by a scientific inquiry. And we've done that in the Western world. We think that science is the pinnacle of all knowledge. We can put it in the test tube and prove it. Well, that's simply not the case. The second thing I want to we're trying to show is that God has given us the answer to our existence in His Word. So this is what we do. We're trying to show that science does not have the answers, so we take two models. We take the creation model, which says God created the world and the earth and all the animals in it in 6 literal days. So we would see life coming very abruptly on earth. And then we take the evolutionist model, which says a single cell organism 3.8 billion years ago was formed and evolved into what we have today. The 40,000 pound blue whale and the 200 foot tall redwood tree all evolved. Okay, those are two what you might consider valid hypotheses. You might say, well, evolution is a valid hypothesis? Sure. A hypothesis is just an idea to explain observations in nature. So what you do then is you take the two models. We call this a model comparison. We take the creation model and we take the evolutionary model. And we go out into nature and we look for observations in the science and we say, which observations better predict the models? And it's actually the observations, the evidence, that goes back and predicts the model we see. And I think when you approach science that way, what you find is that the world around us always predicts the creation model. And that's what we're going to point out tonight. And a person might say, well, I don't want to be seen as a crazy fundamental creationist. You know what? If we're out there to try to look noble in the eyes of the scientific community, then we've already taken one step toward a loss of our faith. The Scripture says in 1 Corinthians 1:18, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God, for it is written, 'I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent.'" Let's review now what we've studied the past few weeks. Question number one, what is one type of evolution anyone can answer that feels comfortable in this class? What is one type of evolution that we all agree takes place? Microevolution. What is microevolution also known as? What are other names for it? Variation within a kind, horizontal evolution, or the special theory of evolution. Okay, that all means variation within a kind. Number two, what type of evolution has never been proven scientifically to occur? Macroevolution, also known as vertical, or neo-Darwinism, or the general theory of evolution. And finally, number five, why is neo-Darwinian evolution technically an unscientific philosophy? Because it's not falsifiable, which means it can't be proven. It does not meet the rigors of the four-tiered scientific method. So there's a scientific method or empirical method, similar, slightly different, based on whose definition. Last week we looked at four things that have been disproved that are still taught in schools today. Animal homology, embryology, the peppered moth, and alleged horse evolution have all been disproved by evolutionists and yet are still taught to students today. Tonight we're going to look at three more. Darwin's finches, fruit flies, and vestigial organs. And the emphasis tonight, and I'm glad Al asked a question last week, tonight we're going to look at mutations, okay? And we're going to show that the Neo-Darwinism, the modern evolutionary synthesis, is dead, according to the scientific community itself. For 40 years, they've been looking for a new idea, and the reason you're not hearing this is because they don't have a new idea yet. But basically, gene-level mutation leading to gradual change, leading to macroevolution, that idea has been dead for 30 years. So first let's look at Darwin's finches. In 1831, when Darwin sailed from England around the world on the HMS Beagle as a naturalist on the ship, he went to various places and observed especially geology. That was really what he wasn't looking for, life science. He was really looking at geology. But on the way, he did evaluate different animal species. And so he looked at the finches. And what he was told growing up in the Anglican Church was that there was a fixity of species. However you see a species in the wild, that must be the way that God created it. If you see a dog, wolf, dingo, coyote, or jackal, even though they can all interbreed, the Anglican Church said, nope, these are, God created them exactly as you see. Well, what did we study? Is there no variation, or is the animal species fixed as far as we understand? Okay, if the animal species is not fixed, then what is fixed? Kinds. From Genesis 1:24, then God said, "Let the earth bring forth a living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind." And we saw that the study of baraminology amongst creationists is the study of determining what those original kinds were. And we believe that the original kind of the canine kind, of the dog kind, was the gray wolf, from which all modern species have been bred. In fact, the original dogs, there were just a few breeds in the 1600s, and all modern dogs have been bred from them. Well, after 4 years, from 1831 to 1835, in 1835, Charles Darwin and HMS Beagle sailed to the Galapagos Islands just off the coast of Ecuador. And on the Galapagos Islands, there were geographically isolated groups of plants and animals that were able to inbreed for maybe hundreds or even thousands of years. Amongst these animals, Charles Darwin noted 13 types of finches. And he saw there was a variation in these finches. There was a difference in beak color, width, height, and size of the bird. And so Charles Darwin concluded, since there are differences in these beaks, and you know, some are becoming bigger, some are becoming smaller, all these animals must be evolving into a different kind of animal. And so you see some of these early drawings from Darwin. Actually, the more accurate drawings of what we see today. Well, what does this teach us? Does this prove evolution? That there's variation within a kind? Certainly not. There are, different types of bird beaks.
And I would guess in this room there are different types of human beaks. Look at human beak number one up here and compare it to beak number seven. Of course, the beak is the nose. So is there a great difference? Of course. Incredible difference. Notice another picture here. Some of our noses come very small and short. Other noses come a little bit wider. Some are short and narrow. Others are even wider. Some are very long and narrow. And others are long and wide and fat and kind of meaty. Well, what does this prove? All it proves is there is allelic variation within animal kinds. God has created us with different, with genes that code for one or another type of gene. And so He's created what scientists call plasticity within animal kinds. That is, the animal types can bend and change based on their environmental needs. If, the wolf kind. The wolf has genes that code for long hair as well as short hair. But when it's living in a cold environment, which animal is likely to survive better and be able to breed and spread its offspring? The long hair. Now, if those wolves migrate toward Central America, which animals are going to be able to survive better in 115 degree heat in the middle of the summer trying to catch rodents? Well, the ones with shorter hair, and so they're going to pass their genes on, and eventually those allelic variations are going to come out. That's all we're seeing here. When the humans, we notice there are actually four different types of noses in the world. There's a Greek nose, a Roman nose, an Arminid nose, and a Cirid nose. Well, these are all just variations within a kind. I would say there's, maybe in these more difference than some of the birds. Now notice the next picture. There's even a greater difference, I believe, in the dog kind, which we know we've bred these breeds, the Chihuahua and the Great Dane. Since the 1600s, we've selected for these animal characteristics and traits. But they're all dogs. They're not changing into different animals. Now, in the 1970s, it wasn't until the 70s that finally scientists returned to the Galapagos and did some very in-depth studies. They said, let's go back and look at Darwin's finches again and see what we find out. Peter and Rosemary Grant have been going to the Galapagos Islands since 1973. They spend 2 to 6 months every year in the Galapagos looking and measuring these finches. Well, they published some papers and they wrote this book here, How, Why Species Multiply, on Darwin's finches. And they came out with two really amazing conclusions, which, in my opinion, favors creationism. In the evolutionist opinion, it favors evolutionism. Why? Because we have biases and presuppositions. Well, I think it actually fits the creation model better. Here's why. They proved that the beak size oscillates. That is, during periods of drought, when some birds can find food better than others, the beaks change. They become shorter or wider or longer based on environmental conditions. But they don't move in a unidirectional path. They change. They become longer and then they become shorter. And this is only in millimeters. I mean, it's not in lengths that are noticeable to the human eye. But when they measure these, they change. But they notice that they oscillate back and forth. They're not moving in one direction. They're not changing into another kind of animal. Number two, they found that they are interbreeding. These 13 species of finches, actually some of them interbreed. They may not be changing into anything else. They may actually be converging into one. Also, I want you to get this point down, number two. No new genetic material has been added to these birds. Only variation in allelic expression of already existing genes. In order for Darwinian evolution to take place, you would have to have new genes to be added to this gene pool. There is no new material in these finches. Number three, natural selection, variation within a kind, do not prove Darwinian evolution, and a finch is a finch is a finch. Let's look at people and apply it to people again. When you look at people, you see a great variation. Different skin colors, different eye colors, different height. Look at the man on the left and the right. What if they, these men were buried and 10,000 years from now, they were found by anthropologists. What would they think? Well, they may think this shorter guy was the less evolved form that evolved into the taller guy. And down where I work, they actually think this guy on the right is the less evolved guy. But that's another story. Now, when we go on, we actually see there is a greater difference in human population. On the African continent alone, there is a 36-inch difference in some tribes. The African Watusis often are 7 feet in height, as an average height. 7 feet. And yet, in other places in Africa, the African pygmies only average 4 feet in height. That's a 3 foot difference. 36 inches. Can you see the great variation within the humankind? You know, there's a much greater difference here than in those little fishes. What about Neanderthal man and human man? Just to point out here, in the 1800s, Thomas Huxley, who was actually called Darwin's bulldog, he was the one that was outspoken, took Darwin's material and just, you know, ramrodded it down people's throats around the world. Thomas Huxley told Charles Darwin, the only known primate that could be linked to evolution, supposedly, in the 1800s was Neanderthal man. Thomas Huxley told Darwin, do not use Neanderthal man as an example. Because Neanderthal man is a human. And we know that today. In the textbooks at school, they teach, well, this is what humans evolved from. Friends, there is not much difference in these two individuals. First of all, when we look at Neanderthal man, the anthropologists tell us that they used tools, they made jewelry, they played music, they made musical instruments, they buried their dead with rites and rituals and flowers. They had weapons that they formed to hunt with. These were people. These were humans. And they have actually done computer simulations based on the facial structures of the Neanderthal skulls they found to show you what an actual Neanderthal person looked like. You want to see what these scary pre-humans look like? Well, there they are. I would suggest they may look scary to you because of the way they're dressed and the way their hair is done up. I think if you fix these kids' hair and put them in a nice suit of clothes, they may not look too much different than some kids around here. I'll use my children. They may not look too much different than my children. I don't want to offend anyone. What about this next guy? So here's a Neanderthal man. This is a reconstruction based on computer simulations. This is at a museum in Germany. And they say, see, this is a pre-human. He's not a human. But notice they have him there working with tools. You know, this was a man. This was a human. I would suggest that, you know, if you clean him up and put him in modern clothes, he might look like someone you know. Does he look like anyone you know? Like maybe a country singer? To me, he kind of looks like a country singer. That's who he reminded me of. In fact, I would suggest that some of these people, some of these Neanderthals may have been actually in some ways more advanced and more civilized. You ever heard of the so-called Hell's Angels? Back in the 80s and 70s, they were popular. You know, I think this guy might be more civilizing the guy on the motorcycle. So just because someone looks shabby and dirty doesn't mean they're unevolved, you know? If it did, then what would you think of this guy? Another famous musician. Or maybe this guy. Does that mean he's unevolved? What about this guy? Or this guy? You know, just because people are shabby and don't, you know, look right, if they put him in modern clothes, he would look like a human. And all indications, based on anthropology, is that these guys were humans. Yes, they had thicker skulls. Yes, they had about 200 cc greater capacity in the brain. But you know what? We see differences in brain, cranial capacity today. Hitler went around the world in the science of the time. Even Americans were involved in that science of that day. They said the more evolved humans are the ones with bigger brains. They did that until they started going to Africa and found out that many Africans have larger brains than a lot of Germans and Anglo-Saxons. Well, that kind of ended that research. But notice these next two individuals. What about Bao Zhixun and Hei Pingping from Inner Mongolia, China? 7 foot 9 inches versus 2 feet 5 inches. Let me suggest to you, if they could take a Neanderthal skull and compare it to a human skull and say that that's evolution, imagine what they would do if they found these two guys buried 10,000 years from now and dug up this 2 foot 5 inch guy and then a 7 foot 9 inch guy. They would say, well, you know, there's a new race of people. It's the hobbits. They were pre-humans. I don't know if you've heard about the supposed hobbits in, was it New Zealand or Australia that they supposedly found? Pre-humans. Well, I think what we see is that animals can vary within their kind, but we do not see them gaining genetic material. We see them losing genes, losing genetic material. That's why you can take a wolf and you can selectively breed him over 100 years and turn him into a poodle, but you can't take a poodle and breed him back into a wolf because he's lost the genes. They're gone. That's not evolution. If anything, it's devolution. It's losing the material that makes him able to survive in the wild. So we see various animal kinds, but they're all in fixed phylogenetic boundaries that cannot be crossed. Point number six is fruit fly evolution. Let's look at the fruit flies. When I was in the seventh grade, we had to breed fruit flies for various mutations. There were differences in wing size, shape, abdomen, thorax, eyes, and feet. Various mutations came out, and the favorite mutation, of course, is the four-winged fruit fly. And evolutionists say, see, here we had it. We've proven evolution because we bred a four-winged fruit fly. Well, what about this fruit fly? Well, it's interesting that what he has is a mutation in his gene that allows an extra thorax to develop. So he has two thoraxes developing here. The problem is that the second set of wings are useless. There are no muscles attached to it. In fact, this fly cannot neither fly nor breathe. Have they mutated him? Yes, but they created a genetic freak of nature that doesn't survive past one generation. He's dead. He's gone. So from this, and if you get anything from this lesson tonight, I'd like you to get this. And if you can write this down and remember it, it will be immeasurably helpful in your discussion with people in your school or your teachers on evolution. I call it the fruit fly principle. You can call it wherever you want. The fruit fly principle is this. For Darwinian evolution to be true, persistent morphologically beneficial mutations must occur. The translation is favorable structural changes must be passed down to progeny. Let's back up and analyze that piece by piece. For Darwinian evolution to be true by mutations, you need three things. The mutations need to be, number one, persistent. It has to be a mutation that is passed down successively to the next generation. If the animal is mutated, but the mutations are not passed down to the next generation, then it has nothing to do with Darwinian evolution. Number two, they have to be morphological. That is, they have to be phenotypic. That is, it has to come out in the structure of the animal. It's not enough to say antibiotic resistance or insect resistance to pesticides. You're going to have to change the structure of the animal. Well, these animals are resistant to antibiotics. Well, if the Darwinian theory was that a man evolved from sensitivity to poisons to resistance to poisons, then antibiotic resistance would prove that. But it doesn't. Darwinian evolution says we evolved from a single cell organism into a blue whale or to a redwood tree. Who can believe it? The point is, it has to be morphological. The mutation has to change the structure, the shape, the organs, the limbs of the animal. Number three, it has to be beneficial. That is, it's not enough to be in the wild and be morphological. It has to be able to have a selective advantage to where, when it's released into the wild, it will outcompete the wild type and will become the dominant species. Natural selection, survival of the fittest. You have to meet all three of these criteria. So, how many of these persistent, morphologically beneficial mutations have been found? Zero. Zero. Not one. Richard Dawkins was put on the spot. Some of you may have seen this. I think Daniel Reeves said he saw this, where he was put on the spot and interviewer said, oh, Mr. Dawkins, can you give me an example of, you know, one good mutation that leads to evolution. And Dawkins, you can look it up on the internet. He opens his mouth and there's just a long pause. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't have a response. So this is the world's leading proponent of atheism based on evolution. And he can't provide one mutation. And supposedly there have been millions upon millions upon millions. Who can believe it? Let's go on now and explain why mutations do not prove Darwinian evolution. This is just some further information. What we've given you so far is enough, but this is some more background information. Number one, over 99% of mutations are harmful. We get that not from the creationist literature, that comes from the evolutionist literature, okay?
almost all mutations are harmful. Number two, of the less than 1% of non-lethal mutations, no morphologically beneficial mutations have ever been documented as persisting in a population. Now, the fruit fly is the favorite choice for evolutionists to talk about mutations. If you're ever talking to someone and they want to talk about mutations, say, let's talk about the fruit fly. It's been mutated more than any creature that we know. In fact, we're going to see it from point number three. Because in 1995, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was given to doctors Nusslein, Bolhard, and Weisskaus for a technique that they called saturation mutagenesis. They looked for every possible mutation in the genome of the fruit fly. They did not find one structurally beneficial mutation in the fruit fly. They mutated this thing until there were no mutations left to be found. They couldn't find one that would change it into a different animal. Notice what Jeremy Rifkin said in regard to this. We quoted him earlier. He's an environmental economist. And he points out that Darwinism is actually an empirical or a capitalistic, imperialistic teaching that is used to dominate cultures around the world and destroy the environment. He said X-rays have been used to increase the mutation rate of the fruit fly by 15,000%. All in all, scientists have been able to catalyze the evolutionary process, the equivalent of many millions of years of mutation and evolution. With this tremendous speed up of mutations, scientists have never been able to come up with anything other than another fruit fly. This guy is not a creationist. In fact, his political and social beliefs would be antithetical to ours. We would not really get along. He wouldn't appreciate us. But he's simply showing that they've never proven Darwinian evolution to be true. Soren Lovtre, who is a professor at Umeå University in Sweden, he said the fruit fly, the favorite pet of the insect of the geneticists, seems not to have changed since the remotest of times. If you want to talk to someone about evolution, ask them to tell you about insect evolution. You know what we find when we go to the bottom layers down in the Cambrian for the insects? We find insects that look exactly like our insects today. The dragonfly hasn't evolved in, you know, hundreds of millions of years. The fruit fly hasn't evolved in hundreds of millions of years. Now, that's not me. That's the evolutionist saying that. They can't explain why it's the same animals we have today. Maybe it's because evolution doesn't take place. Macroevolution doesn't take place. Next, number four. Why don't mutations prove Darwinian evolution? Here's a very important point. Neo-Darwinists cannot account for the fact that humans have 30,000 genes, and then when you go back to, say, an E. coli bacterium, it has about 5,000 genes. Now, they can take that E. coli and, you know, change its genetic makeup that it already has to make it resistant to antibiotics. But that's not what we need. For Darwinian evolution to be true, they're going to have to add 25,000 genes to that bacterium to make it evolve into man. Where did all these genes come from? This is another story, and if anyone wants to talk more about it, the only choice they have is to go into an idea called gene redundancy. Based on gene duplication. And just in a nutshell, for 30 seconds, I'll explain it to you. And if you ever talk to someone, they start talking about mutations, you can help them out, educate them a little bit, and say, well, you're a little bit behind the times. If you're going to argue mutations, you need to argue the next step, which is redundant genes. So they say that there are duplicate genes in animals, and we know that there are some. There's some genes and gene families that look similar. And they say that these genes get duplicated, and the duplicate genes that are not expressed, they're, quote, silenced genes, they become evolved over millions of years until finally they're expressed. But that doesn't work because the only way for the genes to get better is to be selected for in the environment. So if they're silenced, they're going to accumulate large amounts of mutations. And then when they're expressed, it's going to just be a mishmash of garbage. And it'll be lethal to the animal. Anyway, that's their only hope. And from there, once they find out that can't work, then they go on to point number five. There are evolutionary scientists and philosophers that admit that mutations cannot account for evolution from microbe to man. We don't have time to look at this comic, but basically this is mocking creationists. You know, the guy here looks similar to Jerry Falwell. I don't think that's coincidental. from the creationist patrol. Anyway, people mock evolution or creationists because, oh, you don't believe in antibiotic resistance. Well, certainly we do. We believe that's variation within a kind. But notice a number of quotes here. These are from people that believe in evolution, but they say Darwinian evolution is dead. We have to come up with a new idea. Arthur Koestler said that educated public continues to believe that Darwin has provided all the relevant answers by the magic formula of random mutations plus natural selection. Random mutations turn out to be irrelevant, and natural selection is a tautology. I want to introduce you to a lady. I know we've talked about her before. Lynn Margulis. She's from the University of Massachusetts Amherst in the Department of Geosciences. She is the world expert in evolution. Okay, she's at the top of the food pyramid. Lynn Margulis won the 2008 Darwin Wallace Medal. This award is given every 50 years to select people who have published and generated research that advances understanding of evolution. Okay, top of the food chain. Also, she looks like a very nice lady. I think she is, but she has a very sharp tongue. So she would have no respect for creationists. In fact, she says some very sharp things about those of us who believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. But notice what she says. For 30 years, she's been saying mutation-level evolution is dead. She says, I have seen no evidence whatsoever that these evolutionary changes can occur through the accumulation of gradual mutations. She goes on to say, Neo-Darwinism, which insists on the slow accrual of mutations by gene-level natural selection, is a complete funk. Okay, the people that know best, the people that are winning awards at the top of the pile in Darwinian evolution or in evolution, say Darwinism is dead. Okay, the book of the week this week is the Altenburg 16. It's subtitled An Exposé of the Evolution Industry. I wish I had time to read through this. I really haven't lately. I've thumbed through it. I've read a few sections. It's just an amazing book. The story goes like this. A journalist, pretty incredible woman, Susan Mazur, broke this story. This is based on 16 scientists who were invited to a conference in Altenburg, Austria. They were invited there because they needed to remix the evolutionary synthesis. In other words, they need to come up with a new idea. These people admit Neo-Darwinism is dead. We've got to think of a new idea. Well, Susan broke this story. It turned out it came out in Science Magazine, the second most prestigious scientific journal in the world. There was a conference that followed this in Rome. I'm going to show you some quotes. And, you know, for creationists, this book is really a gold mine. It's basically showing that everything that has been taught since 1937, which when the modern synthesis, evolutionary synthesis, was developed by Theodosius Dobzhansky, everything since 1937 is completely unscientific. Okay, we'll let the scientists do the talking. Lynn Margulis, quoted in the book, said, Darwin's claim of descent with modification as caused by natural selection is a linguistic fallacy. The notion is, she said, this is what Darwinists think, if we accumulate enough gene change, enough genetic mutations, we explain the passage from one species to another. She says, academic tradition of purported devolutionary description was developed based on what I think is a conceptual topological error. She goes on to say the source of purposeful inherited novelty in evolution, the underlying reason that new species appear, why? Now, don't believe for a minute she doesn't believe in evolution. She does. She knows evolution is true, but she says it is not due to random mutation. She says everything we've been taught is wrong. We're going to have to come up with a new idea. She goes on to say that variation mostly does not come from gradual accumulation of random mutation. And we agree with that. If an animal varies, sometimes it's due to mutations, but they're not good. But notice she goes on to say, a fine scientific literature on this theme. What is the theme? The theme that Neo-Darwinism is dead. A fine scientific literature on this theme actually exists and grows every day. You might be saying, then why haven't we heard about it? If it's been growing for the past 40 years, which we can show quotes, and it has, why haven't we heard about it? She's going to tell you why. And what she says is going to explain the subtitle of this book,
an exposé of the evolutionary industry. This is what she says. It's neglected nearly entirely by the money powerful, the publicity monger of science and the media. I tell you what, when you read this book, it will give you chills to see what goes on under the scenes. It's a political game based on who gets money to fund research. And do you know who decides who gets money to fund research? So I have a collaboration with some universities, so this won't point any one person out if anyone listens to this, but a collaborator from one university is competing for funds, federal funds that I know about, but she's also on the committee in this same pool of funds for a different grant to decide who's going to get the money. The same people that are getting and competing for the money are the ones that sit on the panels to decide who gets the money. It's all political. A man that came out in the 1970s saying neo-Darwinism is dead is Francisco Ayala. Amazing guy. Incidentally, he's a Catholic. And so I think we would have some common ground with him, even though I think he is a more of a theistic or deistic evolutionist. But he teaches at UC Irvine. And with regard to Darwinism being dead, Lynn Margulis says, at that meeting, Ayala agreed with me that this doctrinaire neo-Darwinism is dead. He was a practitioner of neo-Darwinism, but advances in molecular genetics had led him to agree that neo-Darwinism is dead. Another man that's interviewed in this book is Dr. Antonio Lima de Feria. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Lund in Sweden. And he said, notice this, the experimental results have been available for the last 35 years. He says, we've known that Darwinian evolution is dead, but have been ignored or silenced. Why? To avoid creating cracks in an edifice based on randomness and selection. In other words, you can't let this information out because it'll show that everything that's been taught in textbooks is wrong. Another man that really led to a lot of this is he's a pretty incredible and interesting character. Jerry Fedor, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So he's a world-renowned, accredited, award-winning philosopher at Rutgers University. He came from Princeton, got his PhD there. And you notice that it's oftentimes the older people. Have you noticed that? It's the older scientists that are making these statements. Do you know why that is? Because if they had made the statements 30 or 40 years ago, they wouldn't be making the statements today because they would be unemployed. Or they would be teaching at a community college somewhere. They would not have risen in science if they had opposed Darwinian evolution years ago. Well, Fedor is now in his early 70s, I believe. And notice what he said in 2007 in an article entitled Why Pigs Don't Have Wings. He said, this is what the neo-Darwinists think. He says, it works by selection of traits produced by random variations in the genes. That's essentially Darwin's hypothesis. These dots in here are actually his. Those aren't mine. He says, I think not. There's something wrong with the theory. It goes deep. This article shook the evolutionary community. And there were huge debates. You can go online and see some of the debates. Susan Mazur lists some of these in here. He was severely castigated, but he was simply saying the truth. Do you know what else is interesting about this guy? He's one of the most well-known atheistic philosophers in the world. This guy's an atheist. He has no chips in the game. He has nothing to gain by disproving Darwinian evolution. He says, evolution is true. We just have to come up with a new idea. Now let's roll back the clock. You know, this isn't anything new. You can go back decades. In 1977, Pierre-Paul Grasse, arguably one of the most prolific and knowledgeable zoologists in the world. He said, this is 1977, if you can follow this, the opportune appearance of mutations permitting animals and plants to meet their needs seems hard to believe. Yet, the Darwinian theory is even more demanding. A single plant, he says, a single animal would require thousands and thousands of lucky, appropriate events. That's mutations. Thus, miracles would become the rule. He says, there is no law against daydreaming, but science must not indulge in it. He rejects Darwinian evolution. We don't have time tonight, but he holds one of the ideas. There are two major ideas that are being suggested to replace Darwinian evolution. I tell you what, they're even more far-fetched. And it would be nice if they got rid of neo-Darwinism and introduced these other ideas, because they're even easier to refute, in my opinion. Brian Charlesworth, who's at the University of Chicago and is now at Edinburgh, has won numerous awards on evolution. He said there is nothing in the evolutionary or development biology that justifies their assumptions that a successful mutation is always associated with an increase in some global measure of phenotype. What he's saying is there's never been any proof that you can create mutations that changes the structure of the animal. Now notice what he calls it. You see what I've underlined and italicized here? Assumptions. Assumptions. And this is what they're saying. This is the whole premise. This is the whole lesson in a nutshell. Darwinian evolution assumes that mutations have led to all the changes in animals. But that's their foundation. But the mutations have never been proved. It's an assumption. Okay, now you've got that. Notice what he says next. If these assumptions are removed, the whole edifice collapses. That's why neo-Darwinism is being rejected. Mutations with drastic phenotypic effects are overwhelmingly likely to cause disorganization of development, as a glance around the Drosophila lab will convince anyone. Back in 1953, C.P. Martin said, there is no clear evidence that the existence of such helpful mutations, or no clear evidence of the existence, in natural populations, endless millions of small and great genetic differences exist, but there is no evidence that they arose by mutation. Now, which model fits better, the creationist model or the evolutionist? They're saying, we see the differences in nature, but we can't account for them by mutations. Dr. Nilsson Herbert, also a Swedish geneticist, also in 1953, decades ago, he said, the proof of the occurrence of mutations is by no means proof of a current evolution. It is therefore absolutely impossible to build a current evolution on mutations or on recombinations. This is the last slide to read. So here's another guy at the top of the heap. Kevin Padian. He is from UC Berkeley. He's president of the National Center for Science Education, which is the major group in this country that defends evolution and pushes evolution in schools. Okay, they're the first ones to come out and, you know, in the Dover court case here in Pennsylvania some years back, when evolution was being discussed and maybe creation in schools, these were the guys in the forefront. But notice what he says. He said, does anyone still believe that populations sit around for tens of thousands of years waiting for favorable mutations to occur, then anxiously guard them until enough accumulate toward new and useful change? He said, there you have the mathematical arguments of neo-Darwinism that Waddington and others rightly characterized as vacuous. He says the idea that mutations cause these animals to change is vacuous. What is vacuous? I had to look it up, okay? I had no idea what vacuous meant. But when I looked it up, it makes sense. So it's the idea of a vacuum. He says this idea that mutations cause evolution is empty, useless, lacking intelligence. In conclusion, genetic mutations do not lead to macroevolution. They have to come up with a new idea. There are many different ideas on, you know, how evolution occurred. They know neo-Darwinism isn't true, but they also know that evolution had to have occurred, because if it didn't, the only alternative is intelligent design. So thank you for your attention. If you have any comments or questions, suggestions or corrections, feel free to throw them out. Or if you're not comfortable voicing them, ask someone else to voice it for you, or either write it on a piece of paper and then you can